Hi, J. Vemmer here. This is side two of For the Record program number 787, The Muslim Brotherhood Spring, subtitled I Told You So, being recorded on April 11th of the year 2014. We're catching up on information that I was unable to relate when I was unable to record, and one of those was the outcome of the covert operation known as the Arab Spring. I predicted that it would result in the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power in Egypt and elsewhere, and that the results would be very unpleasant indeed. And we were talking about an article, a post from Raymond Ibrahim, Islam Translated, from February 4th of the year 2014. It's titled, Exposed, the Muslim Brotherhood Al-Qaeda Connection, by Raymond Ibrahim, who's done some very good work translating documents from Arabic and from the Islamic world that we do not get here in the U.S. And I'm going to read this post into the record. It excerpts, concerning some of the more severe allegations against Morsi, one of Egypt's most widely distributed and read newspapers, Al-Watan, W-A-T-A-N as in Nancy, recently published what it said were recorded conversations between Morsi and Muhammad Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda leader Ayman Zawahiri's brother. In these reports, Watan repeatedly asserts that Egyptian security and intelligence agencies confirmed or perhaps leaked out the recordings. Much of the substance of the alleged conversations is further corroborated by events that occurred during Morsi's one-year rule, most of which were reported by a variety of Arabic media outlets, though not by Western media. In what follows, I relay, summarize, and translate some of the more significant portions of the Watan reports. Verbatim statements are in quotation marks. In between, I comment on various anecdotes and events, many of which were first broken on my website, that now, in light of these phone conversations, make perfect sense and independently help confirm the authenticity of the recordings. The first recorded call between Mohamed Morsi and Mohamed Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda leader Ayman Zawahiri's brother, lasted for 59 seconds, with Morsi congratulating Zawahiri on his release from prison, where he had been incarcerated for jihadi terrorist activities against Egypt, and assured him that he would not be followed or observed by any Egyptian authorities, and that he, Morsi, was planning on meeting with him soon. Again, this is the brother of the leader of Al-Qaeda after bin Laden was killed. Prior to this first call, Rifa' al-Tatawi, then that's T-A-H-T-A-W-Y, then chief of staff, mediated and arranged matters. The presidential palace continued to communicate regularly with Mohammed Zawahiri, and sources confirmed that he was the link between the Egyptian presidency and his brother Ayman Zawahiri, the Egyptian-born leader of Al-Qaeda. It should be noted that once released, the previously little-known Mohammed Zawahiri did indeed become very visible and vocal in Egypt at times, spearheading the Islamist movement. Parenthetically, we didn't hear about this in the U.S. The next recording between Morsi and Zawahiri lasted for 2 minutes and 56 seconds and took place 1 month after Morsi became president. Morsi informed Zawahiri that the Muslim Brotherhood supports the Mujahideen, or jihadis, and that the Mujahideen should support the Brotherhood in order for them both and the Islamist agenda to prevail in Egypt. This makes sense in the context that, soon after Morsi came to power, the general public did become increasingly critical of him and his policies, including the fact that he was placing only Brotherhood members in Egypt's most important posts, trying quickly to push through a pro-Islamist constitution, and, as Egyptians called it, trying in general to brotherhoodize, unquote, Egypt. This second phone call being longer than the first, Zawahiri took it as an opportunity to congratulate Morsi on his recent presidential victory, which, incidentally, from the very start, was portrayed by some as fraudulent, and expressed his joy that Morsi's presidency could only mean that, quote, all secular infidels would be removed from Egypt, unquote. Then Zawahiri told Morsi, quote, rule according to the Sharia of Allah, or Islamic law, and we will stand next to you. Know that from the start, there is no so-called democracy, so get rid of your opposition, unquote. This assertion comports extremely well with his brother Ayman Zawahiri's views. A former Muslim Brotherhood member himself, some 30 years ago, the Al-Qaeda leader wrote Al-Hisad Al-Mur, The Bitter Harvest, a scathing book condemning the Brotherhood for, quote, taking advantage of the Muslim youth's fervor by steering their one-time passionate Islamic zeal for jihad to conferences and elections, unquote. An entire section dedicated to showing that Islamic Sharia cannot coexist with democracy even appears in Ayman Zawahiri's book. The call ended in agreement that Al-Qaeda would support the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood and the Brotherhood's international branches under the understanding that Morsi would soon implement full Sharia law in Egypt. After this, Muhammad Zawahiri and Khairat al-Shater, the number two man of the Muslim Brotherhood organization, reportedly met regularly. It is interesting to note here that prior to these revelations, U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson was seen visiting with Khairat al-Shater, even though he held no position in the Morsi government, and after the ousting and imprisonment of Morsi and leading Brotherhood members, Republican Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham made it a point to visit the civilian Shater in his prison cell and urged the Egyptian government to release him. The next call, recorded roughly 6 weeks after this last one, again revolved around the theme of solidifying common cooperation between the Egyptian presidency and the Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand, and Al-Qaeda and its jihadi offshoots on the other, specifically in the context of creating jihadi cells inside of Egypt itself devoted to protecting the increasingly unpopular Brotherhood-dominated government. As I reported in December of 2012, Egyptian media were saying that foreign jihadi fighters were appearing in large numbers. One said 3,000 fighters, especially in Sinai. And since the overthrow of the Brotherhood and the military crackdown on its supporters, many of those detained have been exposed as speaking non-Egyptian dialects of Arabic. During this same phone call, Zawahiri was also critical of the Morsi government for still not applying Islamic Sharia throughout Egypt, which, as mentioned, was one of the prerequisites for Al-Qaeda's support. Morsi responded by saying, quote, we are currently in the stage of consolidating power and need the help of all political parties, and we cannot at this time apply the Iranian model or Taliban-style rule in Egypt. It is impossible to do so now, unquote. In fact, while the Brotherhood has repeatedly declared its aspirations for world domination from its very origins, it has always relied on a, quote, gradual, unquote, approach, moving only in stages, with the idea of culminating its full vision only when enough power has been consolidated. In response, Zawahiri told Morsi that, as a show of goodwill, he must, quote, at least release the Mujahideen who were imprisoned during the Mubarak era, as well as all Islamists, as an assurance and part of an pact of cooperation and proof that the old page has turned to a new one, unquote. After that call, and as confirmed by a governmental source, Morsi received a list from Zawahiri containing the names of the most dangerous terrorists in Egyptian jails, some of whom were on death row due to the enormity of their crimes. In fact, as I reported back in August of 2012, many imprisoned terrorists, including from Egypt's notorious Islamic Jihad organization, which was once led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of Al-Qaeda himself, were in fact released from prison under Morsi. 1 year later, in August of 2013. Soon after the removal of Morsi, Egypt's Interior Ministry announced that Egypt was, quote, preparing to cancel any presidential pardons issued during Morsi's era to terrorists or criminals. During this same call, and in the context of pardons, Morsi said he would do his best to facilitate the return of Mohammed's infamous brother and al-Qaeda leader Ayman Zawahiri back to Egypt, quote, with his head held high, unquote, in accordance with Islamist wishes, as well as urge the U.S. to release the blind sheikh and terrorist mastermind Omar Abdul Rahman. Parenthetically, that did in fact happen, we know. The advocacy of the release. Continuing, in March of 2013, I wrote about how Morsi, during his visit to Pakistan, had reportedly met with Ayman Zawahiri and made arrangements to smuggle him back to Sinai. According to a Pakistan source, the meeting was, quote, facilitated by elements of Pakistani intelligence, or ISI, and influential members of the international organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, unquote. The gist of the next two calls between Morsi and Mohammed Zawahiri was that, so long as the former is president, he would see to it that all released jihadis and al-Qaeda operatives are allowed to move freely throughout Egypt and the Sinai, and that the presidential palace would remain in constant contact with Zawahiri to make sure everything is moving to the satisfaction of both parties. Zawahiri further requested that Morsi allow them to develop training camps in Sinai in order to support the Brotherhood through trained militants, along with saying that the Brotherhood intended to form a revolutionary guard to protect him against any coup. Morsi added that, in return for al-Qaeda's and its affiliates' support, not only would he allow them to have such training camps in the Sinai, but he would facilitate their development and give them four facilities to use along the Egyptian-Libyan border. That Libya is mentioned is interesting. According to a Libyan Arabic report I translated back in June of 2013, those who attacked the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, killing Americans, including Ambassador Chris Stevens, were from jihadi cells that had been formed in Libya through Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood support. Those interrogated named Morsi and other top Brotherhood leadership as accomplices. Next, Watan makes several more assertions, all of which are preceded by, quote, according to security and intelligence agencies, unquote. They are that Morsi did indeed, as he promised, and that he facilitated the establishment of four jihadi training camps. Morsi was at that point chief in command of Egypt's armed forces and, through his power of authority, stopped the military from launching any operations, including in the by now al-Qaeda-overrun Sinai Peninsula. That, after Morsi reached Pakistan, he had a one-and-a-half-hour meeting with an associate of Ayman al-Zawahiri in a hotel and possibly spoke with him. That after Morsi returned to Egypt from his trip to Pakistan, he issued another list containing the names of 20 more convicted terrorists considered dangerous to the national security of Egypt, giving them all presidential pardons, despite the fact that national security and intelligence strongly recommended that they not be released on grounds of the threat that they posed. That the Muslim Brotherhood's international wing, including through the agency of Khairat al-Shatir, who had met with U.S. ambassadors to Egypt Ann Patterson and Republican Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham, had provided $50 million to al-Qaeda, in part to support the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. One of the longer conversations between Morsi and Zawahiri reported by Watan is especially telling of al-Qaeda's enmity for secularist Muslims and Coptic Christians, whose churches, some 80 in all, were attacked, burned, and destroyed, some with the al-Qaeda flag furled above them, soon after the ousting of Morsi. I translate portions below. Zawahiri, the teachings of Allah need to be applied and enforced. The secularists have stopped the Islamic Sharia, and the response must be a stop to the building of churches, unquote. That is an odd assertion considering how difficult it already is for Copts to acquire a repair permit for their churches in Egypt. Zawahiri also added that, quote, all those who reject the Sharia must be executed, and all those belonging to the secular media which work to disseminate debauchery and help deviants and Christians to violate the Sharia must also be executed, unquote. Morsi replied, quote, we have taken deterrent measures to combat those few and new legislative measures to limit their media, and in the near future we will shut down these media stations and launch large Islamic media outlets. We are even planning a big budget from the Brotherhood International Group to launch Islamic and jihadi satellite stations to urge on the jihad. There will be a channel for you and the men of Al-Qaeda, and it can be broadcast from Afghanistan, unquote. Undeterred, Zawahiri responded by saying, this is a Christian media, and some of the media personnel are paid by the Coptic Church, and they work with those who oppose the Sharia. Secularist forces are allied with Christian forces, among them Naguib Sawiris, Sawiris, the Christian Jew, unquote. Morsi, soon we will uphold our promises to you, unquote. In fact, there was a period of time when the secular media in Egypt, which was constantly exposing Brotherhood machinations, were under severe attack by the Brotherhood and Islamists of all stripes. Comedian Bassem Youssef was the tip of the iceberg. In one instance, when I noted back in August of 2012, six major media stations were attacked by Brotherhood supporters and their employees severely beaten. The last call recorded between Mohamed Morsi and Mohamed Zawahiri took place on the dawn of June 30th of 2013, the date of the June 30th revolution that ousted Morsi and the Brotherhood. Morsi made the call to Zawahiri in the presence of Assad al-Sheikha, S-H-E-I-K-H-A, Deputy Chief of Presidential Staff, Rafah al-Tatawi, T-A-H-T-A-W-Y, Chief of Presidential Staff, and his personal security. During this last call, Morsi incited Zawahiri to rise against the Egyptian military in Sinai and asked Zawahiri to compel all jihadi and loyalist elements everywhere to come to the aid of the Muslim Brotherhood and neutralize its opponents. Zawahiri reportedly responded by saying, quote, we will fight the military and the police, and we will set the Sinai aflame, unquote. True enough, as I reported on July 4th, quoting from an Arabic report, quote, Al-Qaeda, under the leadership of Mohammed Zawahiri, is currently planning reprisal operations by which to attack the army and the Morsi opposition all around the Republic of Egypt, unquote. The report added that right before the deposing of Morsi, Zawahiri had been arrested and was being interrogated, only to be ordered released by yet another presidential order, and that he had since fled to the Sinai. Also on that same first day of the revolution, Kairat al-Shaper, deputy leader of the Brotherhood, had a meeting with a delegation of jihadi fighters and reiterated Morsi's request that all jihadis come to the aid of Morsi's presidency and the Brotherhood. As Morsi's trial continues, it's only a matter of time before the truth of these allegations and their implications for the United States is known. But one thing is certain. Most of them comport incredibly well with incidents and events that took place under Morsi's government. Again, that from Raymond Ibrahim, Islam Translated. And again, most of what is alleged there dovetails very nicely with what we have been told so far. Now, some more about what has been taking place in Egypt during the time that I was unable to record. Now, note that in the material presented by Al-Watan. There is repeated reference to the Al-Qaeda and jihadist milieu coming to the aid of Morsi and being used as cadre in direct military opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood's opponents in Egypt. And that dovetails very nicely with what we have seen to date. And again, there were reports that members of Jamaat al-Islamiyah would in fact begin carrying out attacks on Morsi's opposition in Egypt. I would also note that what I suspect was the cause for the sort of the straw that broke the camel's back in Egypt, no pun intended, was when Mohamed Morsi appointed a member of Jamaat al-Islamiyah, again an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group that had launched the attacks that killed some 60 tourists in Luxor, one of Egypt's most popular tourist areas, in the late 1990s, when he was appointed to be head of the governor of Luxor. I suspect that that was the last straw, so to speak. From townhall.com of June 16th of 2013, about 2 weeks before the coup, we have the following, a Reuters story. Egypt's Morsi tightens Islamist grip with governor appointments. It reads, Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi became a member of an Islamist group remembered for a bloody attack on Western tourists in the ancient city of Luxor over a decade ago as governor of that province on Sunday. It was one of 17 gubernatorial appointments that put Islamist allies in key positions across the country as Morsi braces for protests on the first anniversary of his inauguration at the end of the month. Seven of the new governors listed by the state news agency are members of the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party, which backed Morsi in elections that followed the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak in 2011, propelling him to power last year. The newly appointed Luxor government, Adel Mohamed El-Kayat, is a member of the Building and Development Party. The party was established by Al-Jamaat al-Islamiyah, an Islamist group that was involved in attacks in Luxor that killed around 60 tourists in the late 1990s, but later officially renounced violence. Again, I suspect that was it, given how dependent Egypt is on tourism. I suspect that was the last straw. And again, note the information which was presented by Raymond Ibrahim in Islam Translated. We have not been told about that in the West. Another of the points that I made in the Arab Spring series, specifically and for the record, 737, 738, and 739, titled Turkish Taffy, when the Arab Spring was going on, and as we were listening to the hosannas and hallelujahs all around, it was said that when the Muslim Brotherhood came to power, if in fact they did, that they would establish a moderate Islamic democracy along the lines of that of Mr. Erdogan in Turkey. I, on the other hand, pointed out that Mr. Erdogan was no moderate Islamist, that in fact he hailed back to the Muslim Brotherhood and the Al-Taqwa milieu, and that was not only had antecedents in the Brotherhood and Islamic fascism, but also networked with people like Jean-Marie Le Pen of the Front National in France, and had antecedents such as Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler. In the time that has elapsed since, my predictions about Mr. Erdogan have been proved only too accurate. I have a number of posts that will be linked, that are linked in the description to the program, from the New York Times of November 15th of 2013, an article by Tim Arango and Ceylon Yeginsu. Turkey moves to silence dissenters, but with one eye on its image abroad. It reads in part, they came away with a tentative agreement, but it was never accepted by the rank-and-file protesters, so the movement was later crushed by the water cannons and tear gas of Mr. Erdogan's police force. Then last month, one of the leaders of those protests, Ayup Mucu, M-U-H-C-U, was summoned by a local prosecutor and interrogated as part of a spreading investigation of those who led the protests. There is no concrete charge yet we were called in to give official statements, unquote, said Mr. Mucciu, an architect and a member of the Toxin Solidarity Platform, a group of activists that played a central role in the demonstrations. For what? Unquote. For the government, the answer seems clear, Mr. Mucciu said, to silence the opposition. It has come to a point where members can't even tweet without fear of being investigated for their thoughts, said Mr. Mucciu. And still more. Mr. Mucciu was one of the few activists still willing to offer a public critique of the government. As the memory begins to fade of those sweeping protests, which began to save Gezi Park in central Istanbul from being razed and became the most serious challenge to Mr. Erdogan's decade in power, the government has moved aggressively against its perceived adversaries. More than 1,000 students, teachers, doctors, and activists, even mosque imams, have been hauled in for questioning for their role in the civic unrest. Dozens of journalists have lost their jobs for reporting on the demonstrations, and one of Turkey's wealthiest families now has an army of tax inspectors digging through its accounts, apparently for giving refuge in a fancy hotel it owns to demonstrators escaping the clouds of tear gas last summer. Turkey's secular opposition, the Republican People's Party, recently circulated a document titled Turkish Government's Retaliation in Gezi, in which it required equated Mr. Erdogan to Machiavelli, skipping down. Some critics and analysts say they have seen something more sinister, a rise in anti-Semitism in a country with strained relations with Israel. In his fiery speeches during the protests, Erdogan blamed an assortment of foreign actors for the unrest, including the interest rate lobby, which many regarded as a code word for Jews and, quote, Zionists, unquote. Some of Turkey's Jews, a community of roughly 15,000, are now emigrating because, according to a recent report in an English-language Turkish newspaper, Hürriyet Daily News, of, quote, anti-Semitism triggered by harsh statements from the Turkish government, unquote. And in an article that appeared in the Daily Mail of Great Britain of June 21st of 2013, a similarity in not only the tactics, but the verbiage used by Erdogan, very similar to that used by Hitler and Mussolini. An article by Max Hastings, Tyrannies Around the World Are Crushing Dissent. In Britain, contempt for the political class is growing. Is it possible that democracy is dying? And skipping down, we read, earlier this month, naive Europeans hailed the 2010 Arab Spring as promising a new era in the Middle East. Yet it seems more likely that those nations, Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, will merely be ruled by new autocrats. Skipping down. Earlier this month, Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan adopted one of the most notorious phrases of the old fascist dictators, quote, my patience is exhausted, unquote. He then committed thousands of riot police with batons and tear gas to remove peaceful protesters from Istanbul's Taksim Square. Erdogan has said that democracy is an instrument to be exploited only as long as it is useful. He is thought to aspire to changing Turkey's constitution and make himself an elected dictator. And in conclusion, we read from NBC News of June 1st of 2013 by Erim Ergin, Humaira Pamuk, and Khan Sezer, unite against fascism. Anti-government protesters clash with Turkish police. It reads in part, crowds of protesters chanting shoulder to shoulder against fascism and government resign marched on Taksim, where hundreds were injured in clashes the day before. Again, Islamic fascism in Turkey, according to those opposing Erdogan. That is what I predicted. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 787, The Muslim Brotherhood Spring, subtitled I Told You So, being recorded on April 11th of 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.